Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking a sledgehammer to, well, probably the most intimidating number in global finance, debt.
It's a big one.
It is. We're diving into some really high-level sources today, analysis originally prepared for CIFES seminars on financial stability, to try and understand the full scale of global liabilities.
And our mission today, it's not just to throw a scary number at you.
Right. We want to answer the question the analysts themselves posed. How much gets too much? We're going to move past the headlines to get at the hidden mechanics, the structure, the sustainability that decides if a country sinks or swims.
Well, we have to start with that headline figure because for 2025, it is it's alarming. The analysis confirms that global debt is staggering. It's threefold GDP.
300%.
300% of everything the world produces in a single year.
Okay, let's just pause on that for a second. Three times the entire global economy. It's a number so large it almost loses meaning. How did we even get here?
It's the inheritance of the last, 15 years or so. Global leverage for 2025 is pegged at around 230%. And a lot of that is attributed to the really low rate environment after 2008.
When borrowing was cheap.
Extremely cheap. Mm. And then you compound that with the massive and necessary spending spree during the pandemic crisis. It's just a mountain of liabilities built when capital cost almost nothing.
And now that debt mountain is colliding with some serious global headwinds, the analysis points to something called secular stagnation.
Yeah, and that's a long-term trend of just sluggish growth. They note it running from the 1950s all the way through 2026.
So for our listeners, what does that actually mean for a government that's struggling with debt?
It means the pressure release valve is closing. I mean, when your economy isn't growing much, your ability to just grow out of your debt, it vanishes.
The denominator isn't getting bigger.
Exactly. And you combine that with a dimming outlook for global GDP, for the OECD, for trade, and the environment for managing this debt gets, well, brutal.
And on top of all that, the analysis flags that debt servicing costs themselves are rising sharply in 2025 and 2026.
Precisely. This is the moment the chickens are coming home to roost. You see major economies needing to spend more on things like defense, and that's happening just as interest rates are much higher globally.
So the cost of carrying that 300% debt load is no longer cheap.
Not at all. And that puts an immense strain on budgets everywhere.
Okay, so let's unpack that. If the debt mountain is massive, then the structure of that debt has to be the key to survival. The sources identify six pillars for sustainability.
That's right. These are like the structural engineering rules of public finance. The first and most immediate goal is stabilizing the debt to GDP ratio.
Just stop it from getting worse.
You have to stop it from growing faster than your economic output. Simple as that.
And the second pillar gets right to the heart of what fuels the fire.
It does. You have to contain the twin engines of debt growth, your current account deficit and your primary budget deficit. If you're running deficits in both, your debt is just going to grow exponentially.
And the analysis points a finger at one country in particular.
It specifically singles out the U.S. primary budget deficit as a current engine of global debt rise.
Whoa, okay, that's a huge claim. Why is the U.S. deficit a global concern?
It's about the scale, the velocity of the borrowing, and of course the dollar's role as the reserve currency. The primary deficit, remember, is the gap before you even count interest payments.
So it's pure overspending.
Right. The sources are saying the U.S. government is spending far more than it collects, period. That constant borrowing sucks up global capital and, you know, it contributes to higher interest rates everywhere, putting pressure on every other country.
That really puts it in a global context. Okay, yeah. What's pillar number three?
Third is widening your range of financing sources, both private and public. You need diverse, committed buyers for your debt. You can't just rely on one or two volatile sources.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
You've got it. And fourth, this is the classic, absolutely crucial rule. Maintain a sustainable average interest rate, meaning the interest rate R must be lower than the GDP growth rate, G.
The famous R less than G, why is that one the absolute bedrock?
Because if R is greater than G, your debt grows faster than your economy all by itself. I mean, if your economy is growing at 2%, but you're paying 4% interest on your debt,
you're falling behind every single year.
Every single year. Even if you balance your primary budget, the interest payments alone make the debt ratio worse. And this leads to a very explicit warning in the analysis.
Which is?
Beware of flexible rates.
Floating rates. So you're completely exposed if the central bank decides to hike.
Exactly. Which brings us to pillar five. Target an average maturity that's as long as possible. You're buying yourself an insurance policy against short-term panic.
You want to avoid that bunching of maturities where all your debt comes due at once.
Yes, because you're forced to refinance, maybe at terrible rates, right in the middle of a crisis. Extending maturity gives you breathing room.
And the last one, pillar six.
Avoid a currency mismatch. Rigorously. If your government revenue comes in, say, euros from exports, but your debt payments are all in U.S. dollars.
A sudden spike in the dollar could bankrupt you overnight.
Completely, irrespective of any other indicator.
So to contain those deficits we mentioned in Pillar 2, we need to understand the plumbing, the balance of payments, or BOP.
The BOP, yeah. It's your country's total financial scorecard with the rest of the world. And it's split into two primary accounts, which, by definition, must always balance.
Let's start with the current account, then. What's in there?
So the current account, the CA, that tracks your income and spending on current trade. The biggest piece is the trade balance goods exports minus imports.
Right.
Then you add in services and, critically, investment income. This is all the interest payments, profits, dividends flowing in and out.
And the other side of the ledger is the capital account. This is where the money for investment lives.
Correct. The capital account, or KA, tracks that. It includes foreign direct investment, portfolio investment. The sources call these non-debt creating flows, because you're selling an asset or equity, not taking on a new loan.
Okay.
Then you track your capital inflows, long-term and short-term, your debt repayments, and it all ends with the change in reserves.
Yeah. And the analysis points out a really crucial mechanic about how this money moves.
Yes. The structure of flows moves from less liquid items toward more liquid items.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning when a country gets into trouble, investors sell their less liquid stuff, like long-term bonds, and they scramble for cash, which drains the country's most liquid asset, its foreign currency reserves.
The classic sign of a capital flight crisis. So when those flows start to dry up, how do we measure how bad the drought is?
There's a hierarchy. You start with gross capital inflows, that's all the money coming in. Then you subtract debt repayments to get net flows. But the truly critical measure is net transfers. That's your net flows minus your interest payments.
So net transfers is the actual usable new money the country has after all its bills are paid.
Exactly. And if net transfers are zero or negative, it means all the new money coming in is just going right back out to service old debt. You're on a financial treadmill.
Just to stay in the same place.
And that's the point where a liquidity crisis is right around the corner.
This brings us to defining risk. We need two kinds of checks, right? Liquidity, can they pay their bills now? And solvency, can they pay them ever?
Right. Liquidity risk is all about flow variables. Can you pay your current bills, usually measured against your export revenue?
What are the red lines there, the warning signs?
For liquidity, you look at key ratios versus exports X. The debt service ratio, which is your principal plus interest payments, should be less than 33% of your exports.
So a third of your export earnings aren't immediately flying out the door.
Right. And the interest ratio, just interest payments alone, should be under 25% of exports.
And then there's solvency. That's the long-term picture, the stock variables.
Exactly. Your long-term ability to repay the whole pile of debt, the classic one, debt to GDP, should ideally be under 100%. For emerging markets, the threshold is even tighter, more like 66%.
Wells.
Debt to exports should be less than 150%. And your reserves, you need enough to cover more than 6 months of imports.
Okay, now this is where it gets really interesting for me, because despite everyone using these ratios, rating agencies, banks, everyone, the sources have a huge warning.
They do, in all caps. Beware of ratios.
Why? They seem so common sense.
Because it's a vital distinction. The debt to GDP ratio compares your total accumulated debt to an annual flow, GDP. It's like comparing the total value of your house to your annual salary.
They're not really comparable units.
Not directly. They don't perfectly reflect your true ability to pay.
So what are the alternatives? How do you get a better picture of long-term solvency?
Well, instead of a static ratio, you should assess the net present value, the NPV of future revenue flows. You project future exports, future tax receipts, and you discount them back to today's value.
That seems a lot more complicated.
It is, but it gives you a much better picture of actual repayment capacity. Or you can compare debt to a country's total assets, not just its GDP. Or just focus on that ability to service metric, the interest to exports ratio.
This all proves the point that structure is so much more important than just size. And the sources have this perfect illustration, two fictional countries, Solvencia and Liquidia.
Yes, and this is the real aha moment. They both start with the exact same public debt to GDP ratio, 100%.
Okay, so let's start with Solvencia. Why is it sustainable?
Solvencia is our model of resilience. It has a diversified export base, big domestic savings, a stable foundation, and critically, its debt is very long-term, average maturity of 12 years.
Wow, 12 years. That's a lot of breathing room. What about the rates?
80% of its debt is locked in at a fixed rate. So if global rates jump from 2% to 5%, Solvencia barely feels it in the short term. And the final piece, no currency mismatch. Its export revenues are in the same currency as its debt.
It's built to last.
It is.
Now let's contrast that with Liquidia. Same headline debt ratio, 100% of GDP, but a totally different destiny.
Liquidia is the classic house of cards. Its exports are not diversified. They rely on hydrocarbons. It's heavily dependent on volatile U.S. capital markets for funding. And its average debt maturity is a dangerously short 3 years.
So they're constantly having to go back to the market for new money.
Constantly, which makes them incredibly vulnerable to changes in sentiment. But the real killer is the interest rate structure.
Let me guess. Floating rates.
66% of its debt is on floating rates. So if global rates rise even a little, their debt costs just explode, and they have that significant currency mismatch.
So if the U.S. Federal Reserve hikes rates, Liquidia gets a double whammy. Higher floating rate payments, A&D, a stronger dollar that makes its debt more expensive to repay.
And just like that, Liquidia is on the brink of crisis. Solvencia, with the same debt ratio, just sails right through. It's a perfect illustration of why maturity, rates, and currency matter more than the headline number.
But all of this analysis, it depends on good data. And that brings us to a final, maybe cynical, but very realistic challenge. The sources state it bluntly.
Better trusting a creditor than its debtor.
Huh. So don't trust the borrower's own numbers.
In international finance, yeah, the borrower's figures can be optimistic or incomplete. If you want the real picture of exposure, you ask people who are owed the money.
Which is why the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, is highlighted.
Yes, the BIS provides creditor-side data. It cracks global bank exposure, so we can see things like the international bank debt of Italy and Spain, or compare Russia's bank debt at around $5.5 million to Ukraine's at $1 million to gauge the banking system's relative exposure.
And finally, which regions does this kind of analysis flag as being high risk right now?
The sources raise significant concerns for sub-Saharan Africa. Many sovereigns there are struggling with high debt and rising credit risk. I mean, Moody's has 7 of the 19 sovereigns in the region on a negative watch.
So the market sees it too.
Yes. And the analysis also points to the thorny issue of emerging market debt to China. It's complex, often lacks transparency, and can come with non-traditional collateral demands.
Okay, let's summarize what we've learned. We started with this huge mountain of global debt, 300% of GDP. But we learned that survival isn't really about the size of the mountain. It's about how you're trying to climb it.
It's about the structure. Stable financing, long maturity, fixed rates, no currency mismatch. The ratio is a starting point, but the resilience of the structure is what counts.
And the most insightful thing from all this is that the simple debt to GDP ratio can be really misleading.
Profoundly misleading. The real indicator of solvency, what truly matters, isn't historical bookkeeping. It's a country's ability to generate sufficient future revenue flows from exports, taxes, investment to service that debt.
Which is much harder to measure than just pulling a number off a chart.
Exactly. Structure defines capacity.
We saw how drastically short maturity and floating rates could cripple a country like Liquidia. So given that we know higher interest rates are combining with rising global defense spending in 2025 and 2026, how many more Liquidia-like debt structures are out there right now being pushed to the brink? What country's specific debt portfolio, its maturity, its currency, its rate mix, would you investigate first?